Hey, it's Rob. It was an amazing week of Survivor, and we had incredible podcasts with Christian Hubicki and Steven on the Know-It-Alls. Make sure you catch those as well. Plus, The Circle was back this week with an AI contestant. Taryn, Mike Bloom, and Puya broke down the first week of drops from The Circle and on Renap. Who did Sam Moore find for the big guest? Find out on this week's Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast, all right here on RHAP. We know reality TV.
Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land. And this is Inside Job, bonus content for subscribers to the Crime Scene feed. You can subscribe at robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed to get your true crime on Tuesdays, as well as bonus content like this. Inside Job brings you conversations with people who know crime, law, and justice from the inside. If you have a story to tell, message us on Twitter at crimescenerhap, that's S-E-E-N, or email us at crimescenerhap@gmail.com. This week on Inside Job, the jury. Lucinda, welcome to Inside Job.
Thank you, Sarah.
So you were on a 10-day case, but do you want to just wind it back a bit and talk about the process to getting into that jury box?
Yeah, well, this is my sort of second round, but this all sort of really hit at the beginning of 2020, and you can only imagine what COVID and all the lockdowns did to every bit of preparation for jurors and for every second case, of course, being delayed appallingly. So they had this extraordinary backlog, and I think many of us know that many people were called up for jury duty who have never been called up before. I think I was, this was the fifth case that I was called up for, ranging from 3 weeks up to 40 weeks. And the 40 week one, I couldn't even begin to fathom how someone could do that. But when the fifth one landed and it was 10 days, I thought, look, it might be best just to knock this over. It was, I teach, and it was the beginning of the school term. It was February, and I thought it would be better to do it now than later. So lobbed along to the district court and then, you know, went through the long process of being chosen.
Then it is a long process. I've done it myself, sitting in that room, seeing that badly acted video that they show you.
But it was your really, honor, oh, it, I know. And it was a very long day, and they finally let us out to lunch. It was quite late, about 2, and they said, you know, are you can be back maybe here at 4. And it was like, oh, come on. So, you know, the day just went on and on and on and on. And then at 4, everything kicked in. And so we actually got into that jury room, and selection happened at like 5 p.m. But that, you know, we had to be COVID tested every day we were there. So, it, you know, that started an hour before ever arriving. So it was a longer day, I would suggest, than you know, pre-pandemic.
Yeah, pre-pandemic is very much gentleman's hours.
That's right.
So did you want to give us an overview of the case before you sort of dive into the details?
Yeah, so we knew nothing of the case, of course, until there were probably about 20 of us brought into the courtroom, and all there was the defendant and his lawyers and the judge. It was, you know, very tiny. And this was a retrial of a case that, yeah, had a hung jury. So, and it was a retrial of a case that was 2 years earlier. So, again, COVID had like really, really badly impacted this case that we as a jury were strongly adamant should have been done and dusted 2 years ago. So we, surprisingly, our case actually went on longer than the original case, but I think that was because they were being very, very, very cautious that we would get all the information we required to come to a decision. The defendant was accused of 2 counts of sexual assault,
And then over the 10 days, we had a combination of recorded footage. The plaintiff had recorded her footage, you know, this 18 months, 2 years earlier. And that's what we saw with different attending barristers, actually. So, you know, we were hearing different voices. And so we watched all of that on video. Sadly, for the defendant, his testimony, they had failed to capture the video. The technology didn't work. So all of his was just recorded. He's there in the room with us, but we only ever were able to hear the recording. Towards the end, that last few days, we did get a couple of live witnesses, but so much of it was just listening, you know, like watching and listening to everything that was previously asked. So we were hearing the identical, you know, bits of information. We had a massive book of photos and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of text messages, WhatsApp messages from a whole variety of different people. And, you know, very much occurred to me and everyone else in the jury that, wow, I don't know how I would feel about 12 strangers just reading everything I had blurted to a friend or a relative at God knows what time in the morning, drunk or not drunk. And, you know, just being and everything being read over and over and over and over and over again over 10 days, you know, I mean, like intense, very intense, makes you really, really consider, wow, the trail of information after me would, after all of us with our phones would just be enormous.
And this sexual assault is very underreported. Do you, just in your opinion, is this one of the reasons because you're so laid bare? I mean, they're now no longer able to bring up the plaintiff's, you know, prior sexual history, but this seems very vulnerable to, and I mean, I don't even send naughty texts, but even just some
photos, so many photos, so much on Instagram, so much on Facebook, so many photos of the night, Sarah, and 45 minutes of CCTV footage in a bar with no sound, of course, but we watched every single moment of this couple interacting with each other and others, and having, you know, like you come from a performance background, it was just the most astonishing thing. What she said happened in that bar and what he said happened in that bar and the reality of what happened in the bar were three completely separate things.
And you say that you as a jury, or you in particular, and the rest of your fellow jurors felt that the case should have been done and dusted 2 years ago.
Should have been done and dusted. We could not see what had halted the last jury. I would be really hazarding a guess here, but I was dressed for work, so I was dressed somewhat corporately, jacket, you know, court shoes, you know, that sort of thing. On that group of 20, when they brought up that it was a sexual assault, they asked who is not comfortable proceeding. Six of them, including a couple of gentlemen, put their hands up and said they weren't comfortable to proceed, and they were gone. So I think it was down to about maybe 14 or 15. And then two older women were selected, and the defense requested they both be sent away. And they both had a slightly, I don't know, could work at a weekend markets sort of vibe about them. They seemed, you know, really good women. I think I stuck because I looked corporate, not with them not knowing that everything in me at this point wanted to find this man guilty because sexual assault of a woman, it was just like, bring it on. I'm the feminist in the room, and I'm going to hold him to task. and where there were four women and eight men on the jury. And I was looking at this and I'm going, there's no way I'm going to be very vocal. But as we proceeded through the case, it became clearer and clearer that we couldn't understand. If we were getting the same information that they got, and I believe we were, we could not understand how they couldn't have found not guilty the first time round.
In the jury room, I know you can't, or none of us can talk about details of what happens in the room, but just in general, in terms of the agreement or otherwise between them, were you pretty much of the same mind?
Yes, pretty much of the same mind. Surprisingly, where there was a really big cross section, where there were four baby boomers, and then a whole pile of everyone else, right down to an 18-year-old, and they were such a mixed group. Absolutely lovely. Like, we did get on well. We had a very dominant boomer male who wanted to be the sort of head of the jury from the go-get. He made that very clear, and we were happy to give him that job, because I think if we'd said no to that, he would have struggled. But we did keep him in check. Just some old attitudes. Very, very, very nice man. Lovely, delightful man, but just some really old attitudes popping in. Because it was the entire thing, Sarah, was he said, she said. Everything was around just what seems more sensible, what seems more likely to have actually happened, because there was, you know, really zero evidence, and just these two contrasting stories. And when it finally came to it on that very last day, the judge, who was so delightful but did speak a lot, and he said, I'm going to wrap this up. It'll take about 45 minutes. That 45 minutes went on for 3 hours, and we're looking at our clocks and it's coming up to Friday afternoon, and we are, you know, nothing, no evidence has landed in this last couple of days that is really shifting our approach very much. And we are looking for it. And it was 3. And he said, well, we'll be finishing today at 4, but if you need any more time, you know, just send through a note and we'll give you some more time. And when we got in there, the bottom line was we made a decision that we wanted to finish it today and not drag it on to next week. And I was surprised at the variations of not guilty, and I was surprised at where they came from. But the bottom line is we could not in any good faith find him guilty on the evidence that we had. And these somewhat fanciful stories from multiple different sources that didn't add up. We had this incredible timeline, you know, this person was at this place at this moment, 15 minutes later they were in an Uber, 5 minutes later they were in a car, then they were back in an apartment, then they were back at a pub. We had this time, incredibly intricate timeline over the course of one day, one afternoon and one evening, and everything took place on that one day. And this was the first meeting between these two people. They were strangers to each other. They had met on Bumble. So this timeline had to make sense to us. You know, we know Sydney really well, and just the distance and time it would take to get from one place to the other. And there were just so many, there were huge inconsistencies. And there was huge inconsistencies in the items of clothing that were presented to the police and the items of clothing that weren't, that suddenly went missing. And these ones that suddenly went missing, you know, weren't given to the police, were the ones that we needed. And so none of it was really adding up to us. And without, I don't think, disclosing very much about what went on in the jury room, the bottom line is I think there was ultimately an agreement, certainly in me, that this was just a terrible night. A couple had a terrible night, a whole pile of miscommunication, a whole pile of misunderstandings, and an awful evening. But whether that transpired into assault, we could not in any possibility determine.
And so when we asked for another half an hour, we went back. It was now, it was closer to five. Everyone was there. It was only a few key people. Oh, because our police prosecutor got COVID as well. I mean, it was, you know, it's all of that. So he was on video. And keeping in mind, this case had gone on for 2 years, and the gentleman, the defendant, had, I would suggest, lost 4 stone. I mean, that really old terminology there. I'd say, you know, over 20 kilos. And he had a mask on the whole time. We all had masks on the whole time. So it was very hard to sort of capture his sense. But when, you know, our foreman said, you know, not guilty, I myself have never, ever in my life seen relief like I saw on his face. I mean, his knees buckled from under him. And when the judge very kindly said, you know, sir, you're allowed to, you know, collect your bag, get your umbrella and go and sit in, go and, you know, sit down over there because you're no longer on trial. And he just, he really was trying to hang in there, but those tears were coming. He was so relieved that this part of his life was, there was a full stop to the end of it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So when you think of the previous jury 2 years before, let me put this almost legally, did you form an opinion as to?
We did form an opinion. We formed an opinion that someone wanted, someone that may have been perceived as an alpha male, to face consequences for what was ungentlemanly behaviour, which he fully admits. He fully admitted that he didn't act in a gentlemanly way and that there were expectations around someone returning to your apartment at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, there's expectations around why they're there and that he shouldn't have had those expectations.
Yes, I'm glad you said that.
Yes,
that's right. Unfounded and
exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, and yeah. So yeah, there was, again, going back, Sarah, to the timeline and the sequence of events, we just had to go with what made the most sense and, you know, just what made the most sense. And so, yes, I think, you know, they will both carry this with them. Undoubtedly, she would have been devastated by our decision and, you know, and that sort of hung really hard on our shoulders, but we couldn't, in all honesty, sort of proceed on the possibility that something happened when there was no evidence, and the evidence and the stories that we were given really, in all rationale, didn't make any actual sense.
Now, you're a performing arts professional, so you have a particular view of the court proceedings and the presentation of evidence and what happened in the jury room. So were you sort of in a two-minded way, part of you involved as the juror and part of you watching as a performing arts person?
I had to check myself over and over and over again that I wasn't in a play, to the point where I was almost, you know, when the police prosecutor or the judge or the defense barrister were speaking, I'd be that close to clapping them, and I'd be doing a lot of nodding, a lot of and I just, 12 angry men just was stuck in my head, and so I was like, well, where am I in this equation? And I hope I don't get into trouble for disclosing this, but there was an American in the jury, and that sort of made it even more sort of fascinating. And I could just see it. I felt like everyone in the room was cast.
by a casting agent. That's what it felt like to me. It was the most perfect cross-section of people. And, yeah, absolutely fascinating. And very difficult, I imagine, if you actually had people in the room, people watching, witnesses coming and going, it would be, you know, you'd be able to stay on the, you know, tops of your toes. When there was so much video evidence and so much just listening and just so much reading, in that wearing a mask and so on in that space, there were definitely times when I know the jury were starting to nod off. Not that they didn't want to stay alert, but they'd just been sitting too long in a sort of somewhat darkish space and, you know, and no natural lights and all that. So, yes, it was very much like theatre and all the aspects of the judge and the robes and the standing and the sitting and the formality and the you've got this book in front of you and it felt like a script and I'm reading this script of who said what to whom and when and then they send an emoji and it just read like a script. And so I had to always keep looking back at the defendant and going, oh, this is a real person with a real life. And it would have been very, if COVID hadn't have been there and the plaintiff had been in the room, it would have been really very, very interesting to have had that dynamic as well. But, you know, we didn't. We just had him.
And Lucinda, what's the aftermath for you? Have you carried it with you? Have you been able to drop it? Does it come back to you?
It does come back to me, and I have certainly spoken to my adult children around caution around what you disclose through just your life just being absolutely curated on social media. And how a group of 12 total strangers may be interpreting what that photo or that text or that emoji. And I mean, they know all that, but it is really precarious. Also the dangers of, not the dangers, but the complexities of dating, online dating sites and, you know, just meeting a stranger and how that night plays out. So, yeah, lots of conversations with my kids and I guess lots of conversations with like-minded friends where we're probably all reasonably cautious, but we're all in our 50s or 60s. So, yes, we are more cautious online than 20-somethings. Yes, for certain, just caution. Caution in the decisions you make, but also caution in what you let out there and how you project yourself in the world in what you write and photograph.
So Lucinda mentioned 12 Angry Men. It's a 1957 film directed by Sidney Lumet. It's an extraordinary work of art. The original poster had the tagline, "It explodes like a stick of dynamite." And it's certainly been parodied through the years. There's a fantastic Amy Schumer version of it, but it's very much worth your while to go back to watch the original.
It is brilliantly made. Of course, astonishingly, not a woman in sight. So, you know, it is absolutely fascinating just to see that, you know, women weren't allowed anywhere near that decision making. But it's a near perfect film. It's a brilliant script and every performance is superb and it's unbelievably brilliantly directed because the director had nothing but a long table and a hot room and a tiny bathroom at the side. And the way the camera pans and moves and the focus shifts is genius. Like it's a incredibly well-made film. It, you know, well worth seeing. And if you're ever on a jury, it will well and truly prepare you for it.
Welcome, Juror M, to Inside Job.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So your case that you were the jury for was at the Supreme Court?
That's right. It was a Supreme Court trial, a murder trial. It was a few years ago now. And it's hard to, without giving too many details away, say what more it was about.
So, Jerry, why don't you start at the end? What was the verdict?
The verdict in our trial was not guilty, and it was an incredibly difficult decision. We had a very long 3-day, what's it called at the end when we discussed the deliberation between us? And 3 days may not sound like a long time, but the trial ran for 6 weeks. And as a jury, we were completely, even though we talked about it for those 6 weeks, most of us were pretty undecided, except for a couple of people who had made up their minds very early. And so we had a fairly long 3-day deliberation, which I just found the most fascinating part of it, because it was when we spoke the most. Really, during the 6 weeks of the trial, you're sitting in a jury room sometimes for a couple of hours, but we didn't discuss the case all that much, really, when we were not, when we were not in court. And when we're in court, obviously, we're not talking about it. And because you don't discuss all that much, well, you're not meant to discuss anything when you're at home, we kind of bottled up for 6 weeks, or our jury did for 6 weeks, all our thoughts about it, because it was a fairly gruesome case and very emotional. And so we bottled up our thinking about the case until the deliberation. So for 3 days, we had a really, really long, very, very robust conversation about it. There was no screaming matches or anything like that. Just a lot of incredibly differing opinions. Because that was one of the other fascinating things that I found about being on a jury, was just, there's 12 such different people with such different viewpoints. It's just this random selection of life, which I thought was incredible. And ours was a real cross-section of people. So we deliberated for 3 days, and in that 3 days it was a little bit like 12 Angry Men. There were people started with firm convictions, and by the end of it, as a jury, I guess we just realized that there wasn't enough evidence to, beyond reasonable doubt. There was doubt there in enough of us to start with, and managed to convince the jury that beyond reasonable doubt we couldn't make huge decision, because, when you're talking about a murder trial, people's lives and, are impacted, and, huge decisions to be made. And they're just so... We took it very seriously, as anyone should on a jury, and there just wasn't enough evidence to, beyond reasonable doubt, to make to commit this person.
Was there a thought that you were inclined to think that this person was guilty, but under the law could not find them guilty, or there was genuine doubt as to their guilt?
A bit of both. There was some people, and in hindsight, there were some people on our jury who were convinced that he was, for that he was guilty for various reasons, and that there just wasn't enough evidence there. On the whole, I think we took everything on face value, everything that was presented to us, and the things that weren't presented to us, and the things that we weren't allowed to consider, we didn't consider, and we tried to push them aside. It's so funny, they tell you not to Google any information about a case, and had you Googled information, Googled this case, you would have found information that definitely would have prejudiced you. And I didn't, and I don't know if anyone else did, because no one would own up to it. But so that's interesting, that there were some people who had made their mind up, and were they the people who had some prior information about this person and about this case? Because ours was, it was actually a retrial, so that it had been tried before. So there was a lot of information sort of out there. So I didn't personally. I took my role very seriously and didn't Google any information, and took everything on face value of the information that I was given. So, and I think so did most people on our jury. I think, we can never be sure because no one's going to own up to that.
And so the makeup of the jury, were you the four person?
No, I wasn't the four person. We had half men and women, mostly old. I would say 10 out of our 12 were over 50-ish, but a huge cross-section of people, you know, all walks of life, which in itself was just fascinating, just to be in a room for 6 weeks with these people. And even though you don't get to know each other that well, because no one shares too much of their life, or at my jury, no one shared all that much of their lives. Everyone kept to themselves fairly much. But you do get to know people for 6 weeks, and that was fascinating. And then in the deliberation, when all of a sudden everyone's sort of speaking their mind more, it was like, oh wow, I did not expect that from you. Or, you know, there were some people who you went, wow, I'm surprised that you hold that opinion. Or, you know, so, you know, an incredible sort of look at, you know, humanity.
Did you find that you had all heard a certain piece of evidence or you'd all heard a certain witness, and yet people's memories or attitudes towards that were surprising? On my jury, we had a very weird thing where we all agreed on everything the entire time and then had a lot of trouble with our verdict, even though we all believed the person to be guilty and have now basically had it confirmed that they were. So did you find in the room that there were different you'd all heard the same thing in the court, but there were different interpretations of it in terms of what someone had said or what a piece of evidence might mean?
I wouldn't say it was a fairly straightforward case, because it wasn't, but there was so much evidence. There was, you know, it went for 6 weeks, and there was, you know, we just had just reams and reams of notes and, you know, to wade through at the end. So there was no really conflicting. I would say the interpretation of the biggest difference in the way we interpreted the case was the interpretation of the actual the person who was on trial's character. Was the biggest, because they decided on his personality very quickly and who he was, and I think that informed everything that they heard for the next 6 weeks, and they kept looking at it through those glasses, and witnesses would come in a highly emotional state. And because there was a family involved, a large family involved, I feel like that was the biggest sort of differences in interpretation. Whereas the rest of us, the bulk of us on our jury, tended to be sort of a bit more removed or a bit more aloof and not make a snap judgment on character, which is so easy to do because, you know, they're sitting there in the room with you, and we make judgments every day about people. And, you know, on the bus, we sit on the bus and you make a snap judgment about someone as soon as they walk on. And it's hard not to do that. I think it's hard to, but I think that's the role of a jury is to do that and to go, okay, there's this person and they've done this in their life. But put all that aside. All we can look at is what is presented to us here today, you know, over the course of this trial. And that was really difficult. I think that was really, it is really difficult to do that.
Did the accused in the case that you were the jury on, did they take the stand?
No. They chose not to. And I gather that's fairly common. And that they advise them not to, because as soon as they open their mouths, you know, the jury is going to make these judgments about them, and they just have to slip up one little answer from someone, and the jury goes, oh, okay. So I I gather that that happens very rarely, but no, we didn't hear a word from them, you know, not one word.
And were you instructed not to draw any conclusions from the fact that they didn't take the stand?
Yes. Yeah.
So in the room, this 3 days, was there ever a feeling from anyone of let's get on with it, let's get it over with, I'm missing work for this? Or, I mean, you spoke about taking it seriously yourself and that your fellow jurors tended to as well. How did it last for 3 days, I suppose, without going into detail of what you were actually discussing?
No. There was never a hint of anyone saying we're wasting time and wanting to hurry it up at all. You know, I feel like I was on an excellent jury. I feel like everyone, you know, everybody took copious notes and everyone had weighed in, you know, on the whole. There was a couple of people who didn't weigh in and made up their mind, but on the whole, the bulk of us, and I guess when you're on a jury, the bulk of the voices, you know, like any sort of, you know, sort of carries the day. And there were, I guess why it went for 3 days is that because there were a couple of people who were just, you know, we found when we brought in a verdict of not guilty, but there were people who basically sat down and said, I'm pretty sure that he's guilty, but there's just not enough evidence here. So, but I'm going to find it very hard to, you know, to vote not guilty because of a lot of the evidence and, you know, a lot of the, maybe the judgment that they made of this person. So that was why it took so long, is that they just needed to go over everything again and sort of satisfy themselves that they can let someone go, you know, walk free, who in their heart of hearts, I think they thought was guilty, but in their head and what they've been told and what they're instructed to by the judge, you know, to take only this into account, this information into account, and on this information alone, you know, I can reach a conclusion. So I guess it was for them, it was just battling their heart over their head. And really the 3 days was spent just talking about and not even convincing these people, but just giving them the time and the space to reach a, you know, to be satisfied in their own mind.
And in that room for that 3 days, did you surprise yourself at all, or was it as you had anticipated it would be for you?
I guess no. I don't think I surprised myself, but I was certainly one of the more vocal people in the room. You know, in the discussions, carrying the discussions, there was, you know, maybe two or three of us who were sort of the most vocal in trying to convince the others, or just. Not convince. Convince. I feel like convince is the wrong word in the jury room. It's just, yep. You know, to bring up your, I guess, you know, just put forth your opinions. I didn't surprise myself, but I was really pleased with myself that I didn't just sit back and make a decision and then sit with it. And I was really pleased with the other people who eventually sort of came around and eventually sort of said, yeah, eventually we all agree. It was a unanimous decision, you know, so we came to a unanimous decision. I was really pleased that those people didn't hold out and be stubborn, and because, you know, I can imagine if you had personalities who were just like, you know, we had a couple of big personalities and who came out straight away and said, that profess their dislike of the accused and things like that, and how they were sure he's guilty, but on everything on all the evidence that we were presented, there's just not enough for me to say beyond reasonable doubt. But they still had it kind of made them angry, you know, in a way that they couldn't, you know, find this person guilty. And I think I wasn't like that. I was treating it very, very on face value, everything on face value. I took it as I don't have no interest in this. There's no self-interest here. I have no opinion about this person. All I'm going to do is make an opinion based on on the evidence that I've been given. So, I guess we tried to leave emotion out of it. And for the whole, I think we did that as a jury. I think we left emotion out of it, you know, apart from a couple of sort of robust discussions that we had about the character of the accused. And I was in that camp. I was in the camp of saying, well, that's not up to us, you know, whether we like them, whether what we think about them personally is, you know, is irrelevant here. And so putting that aside and at the end of the day, we were all able to do that, to put that aside.
And when you went back into the court to deliver your verdict, who was there other than the accused and the officers of the court, the judge and the lawyers and so on?
Well, my case was during COVID. So our court was empty apart from anyone who had to be there. So there was no family. We were all spread. The jury was all spread out, safely distanced. So there was no one in the court apart from the officers and, you know, people who had to be there for the decision. But weirdly enough, and we didn't know this at the time, but there were obviously family outside our court. Because when the decision was handed down, there was a, you know, big ruckus outside, you know, screams and you know, noise from, I would say, both sides of, you know, people happy and people angry at the decision. But we didn't know that until we delivered the verdict. So that really shocked us as a jury, because we hadn't seen, you know, we hadn't seen people in the actual room. Well, there'd been some people in the room and a lot of people on monitors. You know, giving evidence on monitors. But that really surprised us as a jury. We went, oh, my God. So I can't imagine being in a – I imagine the amount of pressure, and it was so tense. That was the most tense thing I've ever been a part of, that moment when we file in and deliver your verdict. It was, you know, my heart was just, all of us, you know, my heart was just beating through my chest. So I can't imagine how even more difficult it would be when there are people in the court who are, you know, family and victims' families and people like that. I mean, they're facing you, looking at you. I mean, it was the most, you know, intense thing I've ever had to do.
And the aftermath for you, did you come down from this intensity easily, or did you think about the case on and off for a while? Or what was your recovery, I suppose, if recovery is the right word?
Yeah, no, I think recovery is a good word, because, I mean, God, they offer you counselling after it, so they mustn't do, they do that for a reason, obviously. I mean, I just talked about it a lot, from what you're allowed, you know, meant to talk about. I talked about it a lot with family and friends, because it was good to finally talk about it after 6 weeks, after not talking about it. I thought about it a lot. In fact, I still think about it a lot, you know, even quite a long time later. I still think about the other jurors, because they're these people who you make a, you know, momentous decision with, and then you just go off your separate ways and never see again. And, you know, I still sort of recall their faces and recall, you know, their character, and I have no idea who they are. And I always wonder if I'll ever bump into them one day, and if we'd even acknowledge each other. But emotionally, I think the recovery, because it was a very fraught case and very intense case, you know, I can still recall incredibly vividly pictures that you know, images that you're forced to look at and things like that. So it's something that stays with you, and not in a bad way. I don't feel like I was, you know, I don't feel, you know, psychologically scarred or damaged by it in any way, just in fact, quite privileged to have gone through it. You know, I feel it was one of the great privileges of my life to have done, actually, to have, you know, been given this responsibility, and to have taken it very seriously. And for my, you know, peers, for want of a better word, you know, my 11 other randomly selected humans, to also take it very seriously, and you know, And I thought we, as I said before, I thought we performed really well as a jury. So, you know, it was one of the most satisfying and experiences of my life, but definitely remained with me and still remains with me. And, I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Crime Scene is a true crime review podcast where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told. Subscribe to our feed at robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. You can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine. Follow Mari at Mari Talks Too Much. That's two, like the number two. And follow Crime Scene at Crime Scene RHAP. That's S-E-E-N. Many thanks to Lucinda. Thanks to Jura M for sharing their experience with us, to Will from America for the theme music, Tricky Rice for the graphics, and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes.